说完这些，我以为是日本国定的稿子，怎么也操
了。Okay, let's see a new.
Well, yeah, I mean, we just want to finish off tomorrow, but we haven't discussed this element yet, which is this is Reuven, right?
Reuven,
Ketzir Chitim.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so Daf Tzadik Tes Amud Beis, right? Something very, very fascinating here. So Gemara says like this, let's put our heads back into where we're holding. Daf Tzadik Tes Amud Beis, Chelek, Sanhedrin, and we are dealing with the problem of Menashe, right? Do you remember Menashe had the problem of why the Torah mentions certain agadita? Why would the Torah mention stories that don't have any output or any purpose, any reason, no halachic? Right? You remember that, Menashe? Menashe, what was the source of his idolatry? Despite the fact that he was a very great Talmud Chacham, an amazingly learned person, his problem was that Moshe Rabbeinu should not have written in the Torah various sections that have no purpose. So what were the two things it says like this? V'achais loitan timna. Why does it tell you that the sister of Lotan was Timna, but Timna haisa pilega shel Alifas, and Timna was a concubine to Alifas? And similarly, why does the Torah... that is useless information. And secondly, v'yelech Reuven b'mei ketzir chitim. Reuven went in the days of the harvest of the wheat, v'yimtza dudoim b'sodeh, and he found dudoim in the sodeh, right? He found mandrakes in the field. These were the roots that he gave to his mother. Remember that? Leah took them. And Leah asked, remember what the story of the dudoim? Leah got the dudoim. These are things that increase fertility, will help a woman to have a child. So she got them, and she negotiated with Rachel, yeah, that she would give her the mandrakes, and she would earn the right that Yaakov would spend that night with her. She went out to greet him, and she said, Eilai Tavor, you come to me tonight, Kischos Charticha, because I have rented you, right? I've hired you. Bududoi Bni, I've got the right to have you with me tonight because I have paid for you with the dudoim of my son. And by the way, who was born from that? Who was born from that relationship?
Yisachar.
Yisachar, right? Yisachar and Zvulun, really, the two, the very tightly connected. In fact, the Gemara says in Erevin that a woman who propositions her husband in a modest fashion, right, a woman who asks her husband for a relationship in a proper way, merits to have children like Yisachar. What says that, right? Because she went to her husband, and some commentaries have asked, what do you mean in a modest fashion? She was pretty blatant. She waited when he came home, and she said, Eli Tavor, right, you come to me tonight, that's very blatant. No, if a woman expresses to her husband her desire to have a relationship with him, right, and the purpose is the correct purpose, and she does it in a refined fashion, that's absolutely, it's wonderful. The result is she has children like Yisachar, right? Very interesting thing. What does all this mean? So Menashe was saying, this is all irrelevant. Who needs this in the Torah? And therefore, that was his kfira, and that's why he became, right, that was the beginning of his idolatry, and that is what the Gemara discussed. Now we need to know what is the purpose of this, of these statements in the Torah. So the Gemara goes like this. The first part we learned was Timna, they should have accepted her. Do you remember we did this? Yes, no? Yes. Timna, right? She went to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. She asked to convert, to become part of the Jewish people, although they weren't the Jewish people yet as we know it today, yeah? But she wanted to attach herself to this family of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, or rather Avraham and Yitzchak. And they rejected her, and the Gemara said that, of course, the disaster came out of that because she then went to attach herself to a different branch of the family, namely to Esav, Eliphaz, and out of her was born Amalek, right? Not good.
I mean, the reason that they rejected her, they must have
doesn't
had a
say.
Good reason.
Yes, they must have.
I mean,
what does
why
it say?
Can we tell them off so badly for that?
It would have been better had they accepted us.
I mean, Avram was the type of person that accepted everyone,
that's
even
right.
Arabs.
That's
if
right.
He
that's
refused,
right.
They must have seen something really
that's
bad.
That's right. My guess is he saw in her the source of
Amalek.
Yeah, but the Gemara says, but you could have modified that. You could have modified that. You could have, you know, if Tzadok says that when Yaakov didn't let Dina marry Esav, Dina, right? He nailed her into a crate so that Esav couldn't see her, right? And he was criticized for that. He was criticized, right? Because Dina, if Esav would have seen Dina, he would have married her, and that would have been a disaster for Dina, right? So Yaakov knew that was a problem. So the reason Dina's not mentioned, the Medrash says, is because she wasn't visible. Why? Because he sealed up in a crate. And that was... So what was wrong with that? So you know the Bale Musa always say... What? Well, no, the Bale Musa say...
A good wife makes a better husband.
Yes, 1 second, you gents are all one step ahead. First, I'm telling you the wrong pshat. Many Bale Musa say because he nailed her into the crate with a bit too much enthusiasm. Of course he had to prevent her marrying Esav. Would you let your daughter marry Esav? I mean, do me a favor. You didn't let your daughter marry Esav. But he should have felt sadder about the fact that his brother couldn't marry his daughter. And the classic Bale Musa say, he nailed the nails into the crate with a bit too much enthusiasm. He should have had more... Which is wrong pshat. It's wrong pshat. It doesn't say that anyway. It's not Chazal, and it's not mashma in the words. It's a classic Musa idea, but it's not based in the pshat. Rav Tzadok says he should have let her marry him. He's criticized because she could have fixed him. She could have fixed him. That's what it says. That's what he says. So anyway, here, that was Eliphaz and Timna. Now, I want to deal with the next part. Vayelech Reuven b'meiketzi chitim. Reuven went in the days of the harvest of the wheat. Amar Rava b'Rebbe Yitzchak, Amar Rav, mikan letzadikim she'en peshtin yedein begezel. From here you learn, the Gemara is obviously suggesting, why does the Torah teach us this? Yeah, this is a piece of a Gadik material, it's not halachic. You know, what do you learn from this? What do you learn to practice in your life different? Because he went and he found mandrakes and gave them to his mother and she bought her, you know, what the relationship with the father. What do you learn in the world from that? That's a story. What do you learn, says Rabbi Yitzchak, that tzaddikim ein peshtin yedein begezel. Tzaddikim do not stretch out their hands in theft.
I said that's possible.
Rashi says, the fact that it was the wheat harvest means that after the wheat was harvested, you were allowed to go into anyone's field and pick up whatever you picked up, right? And therefore, he was very careful, the Torah is fussy, to tell you that he took something that was hefka, and therefore he's not guilty of theft, right? He wouldn't even pick out some roots from somebody's field that belonged to a person unless it was permitted, and therefore you see scrupulous honesty, he's not taking something, and therefore what do we learn? Tzaddikim do not stretch out their hands in theft. What are dudoim? The Gemara goes on to say, whatever these dudoim are, different opinions about what sort of root or herb it is. Now, we need to understand this, right? What is this piece of Gemara telling us? What's being said here? So, the background here is the sugya of possession. What is ownership? What is possession? And what is theft? Right? It's an amazing thing to understand this. What are possessions? And what does it mean that tzaddikim ainen peshtin yedein begezel? They don't stretch out their hands in theft. I mean, you know, theft is something that is so obvious. You don't need a verse in the Torah to tell me, right? You know that mankind is held accountable for theft. It's one of the seven mitzvahs of Bnei Noach, right? So that was well established back in Bereishis. So you don't need a pasuk to tell me that tzaddikim don't steal, right? They don't steal. Also, the language of ainen peshtin yedein, they don't stretch out their hands in theft. That needs explanation as well. So what is being said here? And first, the final question to ask on the sugya is, this idea that tzaddikim don't steal, that they acquire correctly, why does it have to be taught by Reuven finding dudoim? Right? Why does it have to be taught here? This is the way the Torah needs to tell you that you don't steal. Why here? In fact, this occurs a few times in Torah. The classic sources that I can think of, probably the most classic, is Yaakov. The Gemara says he went for Pachim Ketanim, right? He went over the river at night. He was waiting to be attacked by Esav the next day, but he considered it worthwhile going back over the river for Pachim Ketanim, little vessels that he had left behind that he was not prepared to lose, and of course it almost cost him his life, right? Because alone over the river he was attacked by the Sar of Esav, and in fact he was injured. And we learn from this that it was worth all that risk traveling alone at night to go back and get a few little vessels. That's a great mystery. Why is it worth risking your life? And from here, the Gemara says, we learn from this that tzaddikim mamoinam chavim aleim yosem igufam, that the tzaddikim, their possessions are more precious to them than their bodies. Right? There's another place in Chazal that says that. By b'chol nafshecha b'chol moedecha. There the Gemara says you should love Hashem with b'chol nafshecha, with all your life, b'chol moedecha, all your money. So, Gemara asks, if you... If you have to love Hashem with all your life, that means die. If Hashem wants you to die for Him, then of course you have to give all your possessions. Answers the Gemara, no. There's some people whose money is more precious to them than their life. And therefore you have to be told, if your life's more precious to you than their money, give your life. If you're the kind of person whose money more precious to you than your life, give your money. That's weird. What is the Gemara telling you? What kind of person has his money more precious than his life? I mean, are you talking about somebody who's lost touch with reality? He'd rather die than lose his money. First of all, if you die, you lose your money anyway. You lose a few other things too. You know, I mean, there's a few other disadvantages to dying, right? As Rav Moshe Shapiro said. What do you mean? What does it mean? A person would rather lose his, rather guard his money and die? What kind of idiot is that? So many Rishonim say it doesn't mean he'd rather die. It means he's prepared. Yosemi Gufam, he's prepared to put his body through tremendous suffering. He'll take risks. He'll go through tremendous privations, right? He'll go through great extremes to protect his wealth. It's not because he'd rather die.
That's what people do when they go on business many times.
Yeah.
They take big risks.
This person will cause himself, he'll cause himself tremendous suffering, tremendous anguish, right, for his possessions. That's more important to him, right? It's worth going through all of that. And if that applies to tzaddikim, it has to be understood. Why are possessions so important? On the contrary, I would think it's tzaddik, because a person doesn't care about possessions.
It's not just tzaddikim. I mean, Elias is considered like...
We're not talking about a person becoming poor. Here we're talking about a person protecting his wealth, even. Yaakov Avinu is not going to become poor. He's talking about feudal cups and saucers. Again, don't understand. This is not Yaakov going over the river because he left everything he had. This is a man who's just moved home, okay? And he's moved everything. Everything's safe. Then he remembers he left a few cups and saucers.
So wasn't Pachim to do with the oil for the temple later on, for the menorah? So maybe yes, or
that's
wasn't
interesting.
Little...
That's nice. But nevertheless, I mean, why is it, let's ask the question this way, why are Pachim Ketanim so important, even if you, according to your line of thinking, why are they so valuable? That is asking, right? Why is a tzaddik prepared to undergo great privation and danger and anguish for a few insignificant details that he owns? Why? This is not stinginess and selfishness. On the contrary, the Chazal say you should be large when you give things. Be large. Don't fuss over details when you're making a deal with somebody. Don't fuss over the details. Let him get a bit more. Why you didn't fuss over details? Yes. But the question is, why is that so?
You're now spending that time to get it back.
That's
losing
true.
Time again.
Yes. Why are those seconds that you spend?
Because he did it in a permissible way.
What?
Which is always.
What?
He did it in a permissible way.
Fine.
Which
but
is
why?
Always really hard.
That's nice. But why are these seconds so important?
By the
way, huh?
I just travel a little bit at night time.
What? That's another issue. Yeah, you see, it was dangerous. But, the mentality in business, right? The business mentality of the value of things. I had an interesting experience once. I went to a certain community. I'm not going to mention where it was, but this is to their credit. They are very well known. Certain American community where they're very well known as extremely good businessmen. It's a very wealthy community. And they're very, very good businessmen in that community. Very well known. And I was selling some of my CDs. I'd produced sets of my CDs. And there was a young fellow helping me, and we were selling these CDs, making them available to the people. And the CDs were being sold for my charity. I have like a charitable thing, and the charity had produced the CDs, and they were selling them so the charity would earn money through the CDs. And anybody who wanted to contribute to their charity could contribute as well. And these people lined up at the desk to buy the CDs, and we were selling them in a way where if you bought a certain number, you got a certain discount. According to the number, you got a discount, okay? And these very, very wealthy businessmen, they made sure that they got the last penny of discount. Like, in other words, they bought exactly the right number that they get a $5 discount. That they were not prepared to forego $5. They were made sure. So they would stand there, buy a whole pile of the CDs, calculating the last $5 discount, and after they bought them, they gave a $1,000 gift. First they beat the guy down who was selling them for me, so there wouldn't be one penny spent in the acquisition that wasn't necessary, and then $1,000 to talk it to the same cause completely freely. What's the reason? The reason, this is business, that's Docker. There's a mentality. In business, hey, there's a discount, you calculate the discount, you've got to get it. That goes without saying. Now it's Docker, no limitation. $1,000 is a gift, $1,800 now. $45 instead of $50, that was insisted. That's a mentality. I think that's wonderful. I mean, that's great. That's wonderful. You just give $1,000, I would give them the CDs for free. No, no, no. First, I'm buying the CDs. Very good. You see, that's why they're successful. You know why? Because they're good businessmen and give lots of stock. That's why they're successful. You know? So,
Sounds like Brooklyn.
Huh?
Sounds like Brooklyn.
Sounds like a
it was
the community.
Like it was
no
deal.
Big deal.
It was deal. Yeah. It was deal. It was the deal community. That's it. They were very fussy about it. And they gave so generously. You have to know what the business assumptions are, you know. Rabbi Taube had a friend once who he went into a deal and he had a very big building to sell. It was a multi-million-dollar sale. And he got a very good price for the building and the deal was done. And they were meeting, the final meeting, to exchange and make sure everything was up. And a week before the meeting, he discovered a major flaw in the building. He discovered his own building. The other side didn't know. They'd investigated it thoroughly. He became aware of a major flaw in the building. It was some problem with whether it was the plumbing or the heat. A major issue, like a real significant issue. And he struggled with himself for days. I mean, if you disclose this, you know, it would either ruin the deal or cut off an enormous amount of the profits. And eventually he decided, yeah, he's a Jew. He has to be honest. He can't, you know. So they sat around the table, him and his lawyers, and the other side with his advisors and accountants and lawyers. And as the meeting began, he said, gentlemen, I'm sorry to tell you, the goods are not as advertised. I've discovered there's a problem. Okay, it makes a big difference to the value of the building. And I'm inviting you to renegotiate the price. He said to them, so there's definitely a thing with the thing. And therefore, the deal, as far as I'm concerned, this is not a deal anymore. So the other side, they went into a little huddle. And they had a private meeting in the corner of the room. They came back and they said to him, we insist that you go through with the deal as promised. We absolutely insist. You made an offer and you cannot withdraw it now. And we insist on closing the deal. You've already signed the papers. He said, look, I'm telling you, the building is not... So they forced him to sign. He said, if you guys want to do this, fine. He made these profits. Afterwards, it turned out, the lawyers had told the guy, they said, this Jew's trying to cheat you. Okay, he's got a better offer. He's just trying to teach you. He's telling you that there's a problem with the building. He wants to pull out of the deal. He must have a better offer. Hold him to it, right? The guy got his money. There was a problem in the world. They couldn't deal with the honest guy. Can you imagine? I mean, that's called honesty pays. Hey, wow, that's. I mean, you know, he tried to convince them. The more he tried to convince them a problem, the more they were convinced he's trying to get out of the deal, right? What normal guy admits that? Anyway, so, So now, let's understand what the background here is to understand the sugya of possession. What is kinyan? What is a kinyan, right? What is ownership? What does it mean to own something, right? You know, we take this for granted. You own something, it's mine. You take it, it's theft. What actually is kinyan? So it's a very important sugya in Torah, obviously, and it extends to marriage. And the whole sugya of kinyan, obviously, what does this mean? First of all, according to the Pnimius and according to the deeper understanding, there are layers to the self. There are layers to the self. There's the neshama, which has many layers, overlying the neshama is a body, which is a deeper, that means a more broad expression of self, a vessel, outside of the body or clothing, right? Begodim, that's another layer of vessel. Outside of that is a place you live. That's called Heichalos in Kabbalah. Heichalos means chambers. That means, there's you live in realms of vessels, right? One of the layers that a person has is called kinyan. One of the layers you have is things that are not you, but they're attached to you. Possessions, right? Possessions are something in the world, right? Amazing thing. Actually, the world is called Hashem's kinyan, right? The world is called Hashem's kinyan. In what sense does Hashem acquire the world? How does He make a kinyan on the world? There, the reason is because He creates it. The deepest method of kinyan is creation. There are methods of kinyan, right? Exchange, chalipin, the different ways of doing kinyan. Creation from nothing is the most powerful aspect of kinyan, right? When you create something, it's kone hakol, yeah. Actually, not only that, but Avram Avinu was makne hakol. Avram Avinu was the one who made a kinyan to Hashem. He gave Hashem, as it were, gave back possession of the world. But kinyan is a very important concept. It means that Hashem is a kone. He acquires the world as an expression, an outer expression of something that is, so to speak, not him, attached to him. And the things you own are very significantly attached to you, right? This is not just a social convention. You know, if you steal, we're going to just, we're going to action that to keep society in order. The problem with stealing is because it's actually yours. It is actually your thing. When it's stolen, there's a deep infraction here of something very real. And kinyanim are things that are attached to you. They're not you, and yet they become bonded to you. It's no accident that marriage is a kinyan. Marriage is a kinyan. Marriage doesn't mean you own the woman, right? You don't own the lady. It's very clear in marriage law, you do not own her. You can't do anything to her body that she doesn't agree to. You don't own her, right? There's a certain kind of avdus where you do own the person. There's a certain type of avdus where you own the evet. Doesn't mean you can harm him, of course. But you do own him in a certain way. In marriage, you don't own the lady, right? But you do have what's called kinyan. That means there's an attachment. Right? There's an attachment where she becomes part of the persona, right? The two people become linked to each other in a very real way. So this thing of kinyan needs to be understood. One way to approach it is like this. What is the basis of kinyan? By the way, when you manufacture something, that's a very deep aspect of kinyan. Reb Chaim Briska says that, because Yerushalmi in Trumas, Yerushalmi says that if somebody goes into a field, right, let's say you go into a field of hefka, and you work on the field. No one owns the field. You work on it. And you work the field and you produce something. What grows there is yours. What grows there is yours, right? Not mitzad hefka, not because it's hefka. It's yours because you produced it. In work, in fact, there's even a law. If you go into somebody else's field, somebody who owns the field, or you work in somebody's field and you produce goods, right? Whose is it? There's actually a very deep concept that you have an attachment to the stuff that you produced. The truth is, he has to pay you. But really, the halachic concept is he's paying you because it's yours. Since he happens to own the field, he can push you away with money. Right? But it's not like since it grows in his field, it's automatically his. Since it grows in his field, he does have an attachment to it. But since you put the work in, since you did the work, you were the reason that the thing came into being in the world, it gives you a kinyan. There's a very powerful attachment to that thing in the world, right? The ultimate expression of that, of course, is Hashem's creating the world. He makes it his kinyan because that makes it attached to him in that way. So the approach to this is like this. There are two concepts of kinyan. There are two ways to approach the notion of my ownership of something. Anyone like to offer a suggestion? Why is this thing mine? In what? How does my ownership manifest over this thing? What would you say?
You bought it and you possess it. Or it was given to you.
No, I don't mean how did it come to be mine. I mean, how does my ownership manifest?
You can do
it. Right. That's the first concept. I have power over it. I control it. I can destroy it. I can give it away. I can do what I want, right? That's one concept of kinyan or ownership, right? One concept of ownership is power. That means I have jurisdiction here. I have a controlling power here. That's one concept. But there's another one as well. And that is that there's another one as well. And the other one is that, and it's an extension of me. It's part of me. It's not that I have power over here. There's an intrinsic connection of the thing to me. It's an extension of me, right? I extend in the world in a certain way in my body. And beyond my body, I extend into possessions in a certain intrinsic connection. It's not necessarily because I have power over it. Let's take this a little further. The power concept, right? would mean that I own a thing if I conquer it. Conquest, right? If I, for example, in war, the din of war is one nation takes over another one, then the shalal, in English you call that the loot, the booty, that becomes mine. That's conquest. It's a story of power. It's a story of power. It became mine because I took it over, I conquered it, and it's manifest as mine because I control it, right? This is a common thread. That type of ownership control relies on the same parallel as theft. As theft. Theft means it's mine because I took it. I know it's illegal. But, right, the determining characteristic here is power. The wrong version of that is theft, where I'm in power because I took it to myself. The correct version is because I have conquered it, or because I manifest control over it, and as long as I can control it, it's mine. The second grasp of ownership is got nothing to do with control. It's the fact of my intrinsic connection to the thing. And by the way, according to that, it doesn't matter where it is. If I have an intrinsic connection to it, then you steal it. Okay? Your concept of ownership is because you're in possession now in power. But in fact, deeply, it's still mine. If I own something and you come along and steal it, I may no longer have the aspect of possession that by my control. It's still mine. The reason it's still mine is because intrinsically it is connected to me. Okay? These two grasps of ownership, stay with me carefully, it's very important. These two grasps of ownership, one is control, and the second one is a deep inner connection to the thing, are basically Yaakov and Esav. These are basically Yaakov and Esav. Esav's grasp of a thing, of control of a thing, is really possession. That's the concept of might is right. That's the notion in the world of being in control of the thing and having the rights over it and being... Yaakov's connection to possession, by the way, it goes back to Yishmael. Yishmael and Esav both follow this line. Yishmael is Yado Bekol V'Yad Kol Boy. Everybody's hand is in him and his hand is in everybody else. That means the characteristic is... Sorry, I just want to say, when the Torah was given, Hashem went to each nation and he said, would you like my Torah? So each nation asked, what's in it? So Yishmael said, what's in it? And Hashem said, Lo Signov. They're two different midrashim, by the way. One midrash is Lo Sinov. You're not allowed to commit immorality. And they said, well, listen, this is our national... So we are. That's what we do, right?
The same thing.
That's a deep idea as well. There's a machlokes in Mitzvahs B'nai Noach, where adultery is forbidden to non-Jews because it's stealing, or because it's a sexual crime. What is the problem with adultery? Is adultery the fact that it's an immorality, or that it's a theft? Because the lady has a connection to the man she's married to. Adultery means taking away some of that right. That means he's taken a relationship with her. Yet, is that a problem of theft? Taking away a right, a connection of his to his kinyan? That's an interesting debate. But you see, obviously, both elements are true.
The marble was for there was a connection.
So, Yishmael, one medrash says, Yishmael was told Lo Sinov. Another medrash was Lo Signov. Lo Signov, right? It's very hard to say these things without sounding very, prejudiced in the modern liberal world. But there's a national characteristic like that. It's like someone once asked, why is the national characteristic of taking things that don't belong if they have such faith? Because one of the national characteristics of Ishmael's tremendous emunah. They got that from Avraham Avinu, tremendous emunah. They're not playing games with emunah. One great person said, "Halavai, we should have the degree of emunah that they have." I was sitting at the table, I was living in Israel in a place next to an Arab village, a friendly Arab village.
Oh, gosh.
But there were a lot of thefts. All the bicycles and prams were being stolen there. We had to always go and find them in. Of course. So one of the people at the table said, why do they steal so much if they got such emunah? They believe.
It belongs to them.
What?
You think it belongs to them?
Yeah. So my brother in law said, Ishtadlis, it's just Ishtadlis. They're just making the effort. But that's right, because there is that thing, there is. By the way, the truth also, national characteristic of exaggeration and lies. With tremendous conviction. You know, the Arab world will portray a reprisal. What happens after how many? 5 years, there's a bomb goes off, right? Immediately Israelis respond. It's Israeli aggression. It's like, now we're going to punish you for starting with it. But like with tremendous conviction. Once a famous journalist interviewed the foreign minister of the Arab country. And she said to him, why do you people lie so much? He said, it's not lies, it's our culture. It's not lies, that's our culture. He wasn't even embarrassed by the question. It's Yeah.
The idea is ownership and control and extension of yourself.
Mm. So no, you just said two things. The first is control. Control, it's practical. The second is the extension of myself as a complete. Okay. Yeah.
So why does the halakha come out that if you own a pile of wood, I steal it from you and build it into a chair?
Yeah. You claim the machinery. Yeah, you owe me the value, of course, because it's no longer the thing. When you claim a machinery Hashem, or machinery Meisah, where you change the thing, the reason you made a kinyan on it is because you made a kinyan on the new thing. Boy, you owe me the old one. You owe me the old one. You have to pay. If it's no longer in the world, you have to pay me. But kinyan gezela, by the way, is an illegal kinyan. Kinyan gezela means you now have the, you know what you acquired? The obligations. When you make a kinyan gezela, it's not a legal kinyan. Kinyan gezela means you acquired it now by theft. It's to a certain practical extent, it's yours now, but it's only yours for obligation. You have to pay me. Okay? So it begins with Yishmael, right? Yishmael is Yada Bekulva Yad Kulva. Esav also is might is right. And yeah, Esav was told Lo Sirtzach. That was he was told. When he was told what's in the Torah is Lo Sirtzach, right? This is lives by the sword. But the value of that society also is that the basic conception of ownership is really Israeli control. These are the two dimensions. Right? This is the debate. That means the debate between Yaakov and Esav flows through on many levels. And one of the levels of the debate is, what is the real mechanism of kinyan and what is the real expression of ownership? Esav, the Esav world's expression of kinyan, and I'm not saying it's wrong. Kinyan has two elements to it. Ownership has two domains to it. The one domain is power. The one domain is control. It's true that your object, you have the ability to do what you want with it because you're in control. It does manifest as control. But there's a deeper underlying concept which of course appeals to our deep sense of achdus, of oneness, that the thing is united with you. You have there's a deep extension of yourself into the thing. And in as much as you are connected in that way, right, that is clearly marriage is that sort of a kinyan. Marriage is an intrinsic, deep inner connection to things. Not that you have power, shlita, over it. There are certain marital rights that you have, right? There are certain limitations you can impose on the other because of this thing. But the deep inner kinyan here, right, is, and I'm not sure the non-Jewish world sees it that way. I'm not sure they see it as a reconnection of a bashirt that was an original oneness. I don't think they see it that way. I think they see it as an agreed relationship. But anyway, these are the two dimensions. Now, what happens in history is like this. Yaakov and Esav are these two different domains. Okay, what's Esav's work in the world? Esav's work in the world is to control the world. And Yitzchak sees that. Yitzchak sees that Esav is supposed to control the world. He's supposed to master the world and control it, right? And bring it to perfection. Yaakov's work is to connect it to the spiritual source. Okay, what happens is that Esav gets it wrong. Esav gets it wrong, right? He goes off the rails. And so Yaakov buys from him his right. Yaakov buys from him his right. What does he buy from him? The Bechira. He buys it from Esav. And therefore, by the way, when he said to Yitzhak, Anoichi Esav Bechorecha, he was telling the truth. When he said to Yitzhak, Anoichi, the Esav Bechorecha that you're looking for is now here. I bought it from him. He has blown his role in the world, right? The Esav Bechorecha, the Esav that you're looking for, the one who now must master the world and control and bring it to its perfection. I am that Esav Bechorecha. I bought it from him. Bought it al yidei kinyan. What's going on between Yaakov and Esav is a story of ownership. Right? Esav has a certain right in the world. That's called the Bechorecha. It gives him a certain right in the world. Yaakov buys it. Okay? What happens? Listen carefully to what's an amazing story. Esav has to do a certain work in the world. He has to manifest control over the world. And Hashem gives him a woman who's necessary for that. That's Leah. Right? Leah was necessary for that. Leah was the woman who would manifest Esav's control in the world. And she was meant, he was the oldest son, and Yaakov was the younger son. Leah was the older daughter of Laban, Rachel was the younger daughter. And everybody in the world said, the older daughter to the older son, and the younger daughter to the younger son. It was clear. Leah couldn't stand that. She cried and cried. She got something wrong with her eyes from crying. Because it was the worst disaster in the world for her to be married to an Esav, right? So she cried and cried and cried. And what happened? But listen carefully, it's an amazing thing here. When the Torah sets up a destiny, when Hashem sets up an energy in the world, it has to operate. You can't mess around with the way Hashem sets things up in the world. So look what happens. Hashem sets Esav up in the world as a certain power in the world, is to manifest in a certain way. Yaakov in a different way. One of the levels of debate between them is Esav's grasp of Kenyan has to be manifest in a certain way of control and power, and Yaakov is a different concept of Kenyan ownership in the world. Because of who Esav is, he's given Leah. Because of who Yaakov is, he's given Rachel. What happens? The whole plan is changed. Yaakov takes over the persona of Esav, and that's why he has to marry Leah. Why does Yaakov end up marrying two sisters, which is a prohibition normally? Because Esav has blown his role in the world, Yaakov now has to incorporate Esav within him. He now becomes two people. Yaakov now becomes Yaakov and Esav in one. Therefore, he needs both women. He needs Leah to express the Esav side of what he is, and he needs Rachel to express the Rachel side of what he is, right? Because now he has to fulfill both roles in the world. So what happens? What happens? Yaakov and Esav are supposed to be two people who harmonize. How are they supposed to harmonize? Esav is supposed to be the one who manifests power and control over the world. Yaakov is supposed to be the one who connects it up to the world correctly. Okay? What happens is that partnership is distorted and it now becomes a partnership within Yaakov. So what happens? One day Leah, who has a son called Reuven, Reuven goes into the fields and he acquires Dudoim, but the correct Kenyan. The correct Kenyan is totally honest Kenyan, wears total hefka, and no one else has any rights to ownership. So Reuven, now, son of Leah, right, acquires this. What's being said here is like this. You know what the Medrash says about this? Why did she call him Reuven? Re'u ma ben b'ni u'ben chami. Re'u ma ben. Re'u ven. Re'u ma ben b'ni u'ben chami. She named him. See the difference between my son and the son of my father-in-law. See the difference between my son Reuven and his uncle Esav. See the difference. What does she mean? What does the Medrash mean? Esav is a person who goes and takes things by might. He goes and takes things because he takes them. Now they're his. Right? Reuven, descended from Yaakov, is a person who takes things only because he makes a proper Kenyan. What did she mean? See the difference between them. The difference is Esav is a person who takes things because he conquest. He takes them, then they're his. See the difference. Reuven is a person who goes and gets things only because he has a correct right to them. What happens then? Reuven takes these mandrakes. He's acquired correctly, manifesting the difference between him and Esav, and he comes home and gives them to Leah. What does she do? She buys a relationship with her husband. She doesn't... What is she doing here? She's acquiring from her husband a relationship. She pays for it. What does she do? She pays for with the mandrakes. This is a whole story of buying and selling. You have to understand this. The story goes back to Yaakov buying the Bechayra from Esav in a correct transaction. He now has bought that. What's he bought? He's bought the Esav element. What comes out of that? A child is born from the woman who was really Esav's wife. Who's born out of that? Reuven. Reuven manifests the correction of Esav. Esav is the wrong sort of acquisition. Reuven's born out of Yaakov, but from the part of Yaakov, that's the Esav part, comes out a child who now also goes and acquires things in the world, but now he acquires them the way that they should be acquired. What does he do with this child when he has these goods? He goes and he gives them to his mother, and a new acquisition takes place. What does she do? She buys from her husband the right to be with him. And what comes out of that? Yisachar and Zvulun. What is Yisachar and Zvulun? The Yaakov-Esav relationship that should have been. What is Yisachar and Zvulun? Yisachar is the one who goes and does business and earns things in the world and earns them and pays the money to Yisachar who can learn Torah. What comes out of Leah is the original Yaakov-Esav relationship that should have been in the world that's now manifest in her and now comes out. You can't undo the destiny that's meant to be in the world. You can't undo this. That means that Yaakov and Esav were meant to be Yisachar and Zvulun. They were meant to be, Yaakov and Esav was meant to acquire the world, master it, control it. Yaakov was meant to be the one who used it correctly, right? Esav blows it. It has to happen. What happens? Yaakov now buys from Esav the Esav component. He now has a child who puts that into action again. See what's between the uncle and the nephew. Reuven's now, with a scrupulously correctly acquired Dudoim, he now does a new deal. The new deal is she now buys back from her husband the part that she was meant to marry. When Leah marries Yaakov, she is marrying Esav. It's not that Baruch Hashem, she didn't have to marry Esav anymore, now she marries Yaakov. No, it doesn't work like that. She's still marrying Esav. She's marrying the Esav component that's now been acquired. Yaakov has bought Esav from himself. It's now in him. Leah now marries the Esav component. in Yaakov. That's the part she connects to. And who comes out of that? The tikkun of the Yaakov-Esav relationship that she was meant to bring about in the world anyway. And it comes out of Yisachar and Zvulun. And who are these? These are two people who manifest, again, the same correct duality, twin relationship that Yaakov and Esav should have had, right? When Esav would have been the one who takes control of the world and manifests it correctly, and Yaakov connects it up, is now manifesting Yisachar and Zvulun, right?
Why didn't Esav's seed then just disappear from the scene altogether in history? Zrunda's thing.
Esav is always there claiming. Listen, you'll enjoy this. You'll enjoy this. Ru'u ma bein bni u'ben chami. See the difference between my son and the son of the Esav. What's the difference? Esav is in the world. He gives away something correctly. He sells it for full price, fully knowingly, and spends the rest of his life complaining about it. Reuven has the birthright taken away from him, which is something that's really his, and doesn't regret it once on earth. Complain. Again,
so
Reuven is the Bechor.
They're only there in history afterwards to show that we're doing it correct.
But look at the polarity in the world. Esav is the Bechor, okay? And what happens? He completely immorally gives it away and spends the rest of his life trying to kill Yaakov for what he honestly bought from him. Reuven has the Bechor taken away from him, given to Yehuda. He's the real Bechor! And it's taken away, stripped from him, and given to Yehuda, and all he does is justify it. But yeah. The most valuable possession that Esav has is his right to the Bechor, okay? And it gets correctly taken away, and he doesn't deserve it, and he sells it for nothing. And he spends the rest of his life trying to kill the one who bought it from him. Reuven has the Bechor exactly parallel. He's exactly the Esav persona coming out correctly. And he has the Bechor stripped away from him, and all he says, Hashem knows what he's doing, and Yehuda deserves it more than me. Right? Reuven, bam, this is what's happening. The whole of history is this story. And what is Yaakov? Who is Yaakov? This man who marries Leah and produces the Esav in correction. He's the person who goes over the river to worry about little cups and saucers. Because he's teaching you, what's being taught here is that the tzaddik is connected to his possessions because they're part of him. You don't go and collect little cups and saucers because they're worth 2 pence. The only reason you go and collect them is because they're part of your life. A tzaddik ain't pushed in yedein begezel. That means he doesn't have a hand for theft. Nothing goes outside of his domain. Everything that's within his domain is, and therefore, this is the same Yaakov that Chazal say, Lo ra keri biyomav. He never had a drop of seed that went out of him in waste. Not one drop of seed. You know what it says? Reuven reshis oini. Means, the first time a seed ever went out of him was in a relationship with his wife that created Reuven. In his whole adult life until he married, not one drop of seed ever went out of him in waste. Why is that important? Because a man's seed energy is part of his life. Any drop of seed that goes out of a man is part of his essence that was creative potency and potential that got lost and wasted in the world. In Yaakov, there's none of that. Yaakov is totally, his life is totally contained within. There's no part of him that dies. No part of his energy, and therefore no part of his possessions that could ever get lost. When he goes over the river to bring back some cups and saucers, it's because a tzaddik owns goods only because they're his life. Why? The simple understanding goes because he worked for them. He worked for them or spent time earning them or manufacturing them. That means that the half an hour that it took him to make these objects or to earn the money is his life. That's half an hour of his life. Therefore, these objects in the world represent aspect of his life. Therefore, they will get wasted, will represent part of his life that's just no longer there. Just like no seed gets wasted, no property or possession ever gets wasted. By the way, I'll pick Kabbalah. The result of the fact that he risks his life to go over the river and bring home Pachim Ketanim, the result of it is when the Mashiach comes, no Jew will be lost. Because Yaakov goes and makes sure that the most insignificant and distant aspects of his possessions remain attached to him. When Mashiach comes, there will not be one Jewish neshama and one drop of seed that could create a human being that is wandering around in the world unredeemed someplace. That's only because he is the potency, right, that every drop of seed that goes out of him, every moment of his life, every second of his existence is attached to him and remains part of him with a chius, with a life force that is him, right? And therefore...
That's according to one opinion, it must be. There's other opinion.
The ten tribes
won't come back.
No, but they must go, they'll come back, don't worry. The 10 tribes will come back.
What's this thing
about the Yavok? There's something about the big river.
Yavok's a big sugya. It's a river that he goes over at night. It's a very dangerous thing. Right. It crosses the river. It's a very, very dangerous thing into the domain of the other side. That's where Esav is waiting for him. But he goes there. What it means in depth is he's not just bringing home the last possessions. He's bringing them out of the dark side. He has to cross over the river, the river of danger, the river of fire as well. The river that's... Yeah, many references to this Yabok, which is sometimes in the Tefillahs, you'll see they put little dots on the letters when you see it's Yud, Beis, Kuf, And he goes into the dark side and he brings out the Nitzotzes. He's bringing the sparks back from the dark side, right? Over that river, very significant. But that is the idea. And therefore, this is a story, right? Schor schar ticha, she says. The point is not that you are my husband, you'll spend the night with me. The point is I bought this from you. What she was doing was just like Yaakov had bought the Esav component, she's now buying out of Yaakov the Esav component that was meant to be her husband. Right? And out of that relationship, of course, is coming Yisachar and Zvulun.
But why in all this there's a problem? The kinyan between Yaakov and Leah is not the proper one, though.
You mean because he doesn't have the right dice?
Yeah, he doesn't know. He doesn't know who he's marrying.
Therefore, why is it legal?
Yes.
I think the answer is that when he realizes that she was given to him, this must be who was meant to marry. And therefore he understands at that point just like she was meant to marry Esav, and he's now taken over Esav, he needs her. Right? He needs her. And therefore he doesn't try to undo the deal. He doesn't go to Lavan and say the deal's not a deal. He just goes to Lavan and says, where's the other one that I... And he takes them both on, of course. They both become...
So if you got Issachar and Zvulun, which is sort of like the one stage down from Yaakov and Esav.
Yeah.
What do we need the other 10 Shvatim for?
No, everyone's got his own Metzias. What do you mean? Every tribe brings to the world...
One doing the work and one doing the learning. Since all bases are covered.
Yes.
What do the other...
No, each Shevet Yehuda's Malchus. That's a special quality. Yehuda's Malchus. Levi's a different thing. It's Kahuna. Yeah, every Shevet has its own... Obviously, all the Shvatim that are born from Leah must have something in common. Right? They must have something in common. But Yisachar and Zvulun, those are the two who represent exactly where the possessions go in the world. In the world of Hasidim, in the world of Hasidus, this is always like... there's always one who controls. When you go to the Rebbe, you don't give him money. You give it to the Gabbai. There's one who manages it. You give it to the Rebbe, it's ridiculous. He'll give it out to stock immediately. You don't give it to him. He doesn't know what money is, really. There's a gabbai. There's a partnership, right? Give it to the gabbai, it'll get organized. Correctly, right? Or in the old world of the big Talmidei Chachamim, it just sat and learned, nothing else. If there was anything that needed to be given, give it to the wife. Somebody would bring food or money. You give it to him, it's useless. As soon as you give him the money, somebody else comes and he'll just give it away. There's this partnership, right, which is the male-female partnership, Yisachar Zvulun partnership, the Yaakov Esav partnership, right? That's the tikkun, and therefore, this pasuk in the Torah, this is what Menashe said is completely useless, right? Who needs to know that Reuven went, but you make Tzir Chitim? Here the Torah is teaching you, Afka by Reuven, the one who's the correct version of Kinyan in the world, right? Who's the correct version of the Yaakov Esav debate, of the two aspects of Kinyan. The unification of those two aspects of Kinyan. The Kinyan that is possession and control, the Esav dimension. The possession that is an extension of self, the Yaakov dimension, right? Reuven is exactly the one to reassert that in the world. And as a result of that Kinyan, and that whole financial transaction, right, is that I've bought the right from him, schor schar ticha, he acquires the dudoim honestly, there's no theft in those. Those are the price of acquiring the husband, out of that relationship that's bought. It's an amazing story, right? This extends itself also into selling Yosef. Yosef wasn't given away. He was sold for a particular price. It's a whole debate about value and about kinyan and about exactly what that means. It runs through the whole Torah, this theme of kinyan and of course that's the depth of honestly gained wealth and money, and it's not only that it's honest and every non-Jew knows, right, that money's not clean if it's not honestly earned. I mean, that's obvious, that's superficial meaning. But there's something much deeper here, and that is... and now you begin to understand why Gedolim wouldn't take money from certain people. They wouldn't take money from certain... There's a debate about this. Should you take money from a person where it's dishonestly gained, because now you contaminate... Yeah. There were certain Rosh Hashivas who would not take money for the yeshiva from people who weren't Shomer Shabbos. Others would say, give him the schus. That's all he has. He wants the mitzvah tzedakah. Let him at least have the mitzvah tzedakah. He's not kimsha. Others would say, there's an issue here, right? But money that's not clean is problematic. There's an energy that comes with it that is problematic, right? And this is the old debate between the Yaakov dimension and the Esav dimension, the grasp of possession by might and power and control, and the concept of kinyan and possession by virtue of being a meticulously, you know, impeccably clean process in which there's a real ownership, right? A real kinyan. And you can follow this. Obviously, there's a lot more to say about this, and you can follow it through Torah in general. But the reason that it's here, tzadikim en and peshtin yadein begezel, because what they own is genuinely an aspect of who they are, and it's told exactly in the case of Reuven, because you need to know that these honestly gained objects are the reason that the correct relationship comes out of Yaakov, which is the Yaakov-Esav relationship represented by Yisachar and Zvulun, where one in fact does control the world the way Esav should have, one learns Torah the way Yaakov should have, and that's the absolutely quintessential relationship between Yaakov and Esav as manifest through physical possessions in the world. And of course from here you can think for yourselves a lot about the meaning of possessions in the world and ownership and wealth and why some people have it and what it should be used for, why it's a responsibility, why wealth is a special gift and a special privilege, even why Rebbe used to honor people who were wealthy. Why would you do that? Why would honor a person who's wealthy? I mean, what could be less important? No.
Then it sounds like Menashe just didn't get it. He was just...
That's right.
But you said that he was quite knowledgeable.
That's
quite
right. At some level, he didn't understand this. He didn't understand Eliphaz and Timna, who wanted to attach herself to the Jewish people correctly and got it wrong. Yeah, why that's not necessary. He didn't get... There's some aspect of this that he didn't get, absolutely. Or you could say, he would say to you, I know all this, but it's irrelevant, it doesn't have any practical halachic output. This story line in the Torah, okay, that he's meticulously honest and this whole story of Kenyan that's running through, you know, that's... Maybe Menashe would even have attacked the whole story of the Avos altogether, the whole process of the whole Avos bringing the Jewish people into existence. He would say the Torah should start just be a list of mitzvahs. I don't know. What exactly was the distortion in his thinking? What point of this and why this was unnecessary? That I can't say more about that. Okay, next week please look at the program. Right.